Hello and welcome to Insider Insights, where you get to meet non-executive directors and go inside their boardroom. Today we're joined by Dr. Delise Samuel, who will give us her unique perspective of board life and offer up some hints and tips to help you to succeed too. Delise has spent almost 20 years juggling full-time work with board work. Her first role was a state-appointed role as a result of her industry expertise with the International Fibre Centre. She's recently completed 5 years as the secretary of the local tennis club and today serves on the board at the Mulgrave Country Club. So join me now and let's hear from our insider, Dr. Delise Samuel. So Delise, welcome. It's great to have you here today.
Thanks, Ellie. It's really great you asked me.
I'm really curious to know about your career because you have a long and fascinating industry in textiles. Tell us a bit about your background and how you got your first board break.
All right. Okay. So I kind of have done related diversification through my career. We call it, they call it pivoting now because that's the trendy word. But basically, I got a PhD and a degree in textiles from Leeds University in the UK. And that's where I met my husband, who's Australian, and then I came over to Australia. My first role here was in the textile industry, and I was the technical manager of a commission printing company for about 3 years. And that all sort of fell over, got made redundant, ended up teaching for a couple of semesters at RMIT in a course that was sort of textile related back then. And from there, got appointed to work in R&D, in the Walmart company, which I knew from the UK, which is why I sort of applied for the role. So I ended up doing research program management. I was there for about 5 years, decided that I needed to know a lot more stuff. And consequently, I quit that job after about 5 years and I undertook an MBA full time. And that was a major change in my life, if you like, because up to that point with the PhD, and particularly here in Australia, seen as a bit of a nerdy R&D person, and I wanted to get more of the management skills and so on that when I had been at university I thought were a bit, you know, what's management all about? There's all the technical stuff's really good. And so I did that, and that I suppose changed my career, changed my networks, changed the people that I knew, and also opened my eyes up to the idea that you didn't have to let life happen to you. You could actually set some goals and think about, well, where do I want to be in 5-10 years time? Which it sort of, I'd gone through my life to that point, I suppose, I'll do this stuff because it's interesting and because it appeals to me. And I still, to an extent, apply that today. But so one of the things that you do when you do an MBA and you meet all your friends and you have all your new networks and stuff, and you've done lots of group projects and assignments, one of the things was, you know, a lot of people sat there, we want to be on board. You know, that's a really good goal to aim for as an outcome of, you know, new qualifications, moving in different directions and so on. So it was always in the back of my mind that, you know, that's where I want to get to. And so at the end of my MBA, I actually had my third child during that process. So it took a little bit longer because I'd done it full time and I had to drop back to part time to finish it off. I ended up working on a book on organisational performance with a professor of strategy there, and that's kind of how I segued into organisational performance review, evaluation, strategy and all that sort of thing, but always in that innovation research space, which I really, just appeals to my brain. That's what I enjoy. Where's the future growth going to come from? And it was always a challenge for me because here in Australia, there's a lot of focus on efficiency and productivity rather than, or that's how it struck me when I first came here from the UK, that the focus was on that rather than where is the future revenue, the product pipeline, 10 years time looking. So I'm looking much more forward looking around those things. And anyway, I was in the textile thing and I was interested in contributing. I was a member of the Textile Institute, which is the professional body or association for textiles, sort of a global thing, but not huge in Australia, and mainly because the textile industry here is quite small. It was a lot bigger if you go back 25 years ago, but it was pretty non-existent. And I was also a member of another one called the Society of Dyers and Colorists, again, quite specialist in coloration and dyeing, etc. And I had been on the committee for that institute. I can't even remember what my role was now. I'd have to have a look. And got the monthly magazine from them. And in that, I'd noticed one month that there was an ad saying, "Would you like to be on an advisory committee for something or another?" Literally can't even remember what that was. But I thought, you know what? I'll throw my hat in the ring. So I wrote them a letter and I said, you know, I'd be very interested to contribute to the development of the industry, et cetera, if you like, in Australia. And I got a knock back. I didn't get on that, didn't get picked, didn't get selected, but oh well, whatever. Finished my MBA at that point, got a job working at Melbourne University Private, then in their commercialization company. And not long after I had started that, I got a phone call from the person that I'd written that letter to maybe at least 6 months earlier, probably even longer, saying, "Look, you know, you didn't get on this, but I've got this opportunity to be on a board. Would you be interested?" I said, "Yeah, that sounds good." I thought, I was quietly thinking, that sounds even better than an advisory committee, so I'm happy with that. And so I went along and I met with him, and he was the acting CEO of the organization. And I met with him and I met with the chair of the board, who at that point in time was the deputy speaker of the house. So we met in the Parliament of Victoria, and so the private dining room. So it was very swanky and very. And so everybody decided they liked everybody, and that was it. I got said, "You're it, you're on." And then I got a formal letter from the Minister of Education of the State Victorian Government, because it was turned out it was that. So I knew nothing about all of this and how it was. I just went along with the flow of it, and I ended up on that board. At that point, it was not remunerated, but about halfway through, I ended up being on that board for 7 years. They brought everything in line on those sort of state government boards, and they made it be whatever the sitting rate is if you're on a TAFE board or equivalent. So it not much. It was maybe 250 a day, something like that. And I was also on the subcommittee for the project selection. So we used to fund projects in the textile industry to improve the textile industry in Victoria. And so I was on that board for about 7 years. We used to go down, the board meeting was were in Geelong, so the International Fibre Centre is what it was called. And it had been, before I sort of was on the board, it had been this Geoff Kennett vision to bring textile manufacturing back to Victoria and value add to the wool that was produced in Australia. And the first meeting I was there for was the meeting where they reported the sale of the last piece of equipment they had bought under that vision. And they were turning into this more focused organisation, basically, that was handing out money to support the education and training in the textile and fibre industries in Victoria. So that's kind of where it was. I had 7 years on there, as I mentioned before. And it was a really good learning experience for me. I mean, I didn't know what I was getting into to start with, but they did support me to do the Australian Institute of Company Directors course, which was a big deal. You know, so a lot of those, I think a lot of those organisations, they do have funding for that director education. And because they're a non-profit and so on, they can negotiate better rates with the AICD and stuff like that. So that's the point at which I joined the AICD and got the qualification, etc. So that was the key. That was a huge benefit that came out of that, plus the whole learning how boards operate and what they do. So that was my first board appointment.
So you make that sound really haphazard, you know, like
It
I
was a
went into
bit.
this and I went and did that, but the stars all aligned, right? You were collecting all the right skills and experiences and in the right place at the right time and doing the right things all the way. You've done a lot of extracurricular work around committees and advisory type activities along that way. So it wasn't kind of, you know, one day you woke up and on this magical day this role appeared. You put in all the hard work, and it sounds like you had a goal there. So you had some intention that this is going to happen in my future. And I'm a firm believer that once you state that intention, that you know the universe kind of conspires for your success anyway.
Yeah, I think I totally agree, because I don't think, unless you've got that goal mapped out, you don't know that that's the opportunity, and you go, aha. You know, so yes. you know that it's right and it's the right fit. I mean, the opportunity to get that course was worth $10,000. Yes, I put a lot of time and a lot of effort in, but it was in an area that I personally was very interested in and had an affinity for and a passion for. I don't know if I would have done it for any old random thing, but textiles, we talked about it before. I love my fabric collection. So I love textiles to this day. I'll go around feeling everything in the shops and go, oh, that's rubbish. I wouldn't buy that. Polyester City in Australia, natural fiber girl. So I like my wool, like my silk, like my cotton. And so, you know, those things I just love. And I sometimes wonder what would have happened if I'd stayed in the textile industry or connected in manufacturing in some way. Because I really love the idea of making something, of creating some tangible value. So we've all moved a lot into service industries and stuff like that. But I really like making something and standing back and going, I made that happen. I contributed to that. You know, isn't that a lovely thing? So I still really like making stuff.
But so I'm hearing textiles is your passion. What is there a purpose that's aligned to it? I'm hearing that you like making things, you like seeing things eventuate. Is there a purpose that's aligned to your passion for textiles?
I think the theme that runs through my career has always been like this new product development, new service development, the idea, you know, that idea about looking forward, where's the next thing coming from? So that's been a consistent theme throughout my career and everything that I've done. It's like making something that didn't exist before now exists. And so I've always sort of enjoyed that and being very project focused and being clear about being deliverable. So be able to stand back. So choices that I have made in my life, everything that I do, I look at, okay, so what can I deliver from that? What is the value that I can create from being part of that? So everything on my CV, I'd like to think that's what I did with that. So I don't want to keep doing more of the same. I'm always looking for something that is different that I can learn from, but also delivers value, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I don't, you know, that people talk about people having 20 years experience and stuff like that. My 20 years is a lot of different experiences over 20 years, not the same experience every year for 20 years.
Yeah, and some people go broad and some go deep. So
yeah, I would be bored out of my brain if I did the same thing day in, day out. That's just not me. So I sort of have stuck to that thing that I do things because I find them interesting or I feel like I can contribute value or that the thing that I will do makes a difference to the organization too, as well as giving me a learning opportunity. So I look at being the secretary of the tennis club that I've just finished 5 years on. I think I finished in May when we had our AGM. And, you know, that was a really fun project for me. It had a 1982 constitution that looked disgusting. It was a photocopy of a photocopy of a fax, I think. And we had to basically get that updated to the Community Affairs Victoria version. So that meant running the AGM, meant running, doing the special meetings, coming up with special resolutions, going through the process. The biggest hurdle with those old constitutions was the original time thing that you do with that. You had to write to everybody and you had to send everything by mail. And, you know, that was the nightmare. So that was year one. And then in year two, because we've got it through the special resolution in the first AGM, you're now able to digitally communicate with people. But of course, they had no digital assets. No, the logo wasn't digital. So going through all those processes, setting up things like MailChimp for member communication, setting up online invoicing for things, because you've got all these members, but hey, what, they haven't been paying their memberships and all that sort of thing. So that was a really nice thing that I've sort of handed over now after 5 years. And it's taken 5 years because it's not a full-time job. You're doing things in a slow way. It's working all with volunteers. And but you know, you can look back on things like that and you feel like you've made a real difference to something. That's what motivates me, I think.
Yeah, I'm smiling when you say about photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy because
of a fax.
I've actually worked with a board where when I've asked for the constitution, they haven't got it. They just everyone assumed everyone else had it, and they just couldn't physically locate their constitution. And that's crazy when the, you know, the constitution sets out the whole purpose for the business, yeah, and we're not even looking at the document or referring to,
yeah,
it.
But that's a problem with a lot of community organisations, and I think it's a systemic and structural problem in that, you know, the tennis club, for example, had the same committee. You know, these organisations have committees on for years and years and years, and a lot of them are older because they're the ones that are given the time to the community thing, but they don't necessarily have the digital skills and assets. And yeah, I have to tell you this one because it just cracked me up. So our treasurer, lovely guy, was doing stuff every month. And luckily, my husband was the president, actually. And so I got sucked into being the secretary on this, I have to say. I was sort of, what do they call it, seconded for special duty. And the treasurer, he would do his financial reports, and he was doing them on Word. And I've met a lot of people in my life that don't know how to use Excel. I'm doing it Word. And look, the financials weren't terribly complicated. That's okay. So I asked him, could he send me for the annual report all the different months, you know, the 12 months of treasurer's reports? And I found out through that process that every month he would type over the previous month's reports, print them off, bring them to the meeting. There was no saved copy of it because he was working off a 386 computer that didn't have the memory or the capacity to do anything. It was just pure dumb luck that I'd asked the question. I said to him, I was like, where am I going to get the financials from? And he said, well, luckily he saved every copy from every meeting that was handed out. So we were able to scan them. And of course, then we were able to fix it. But you don't even think those things. When you've worked in the corporate world, you take it for granted that everyone's, yeah, got a computer, everybody's got these things. And they don't necessarily, particularly on those types of committees. It was so funny.
You've just hit on a really great point there, because the boardroom is no place for assumptions, right? You just do not assume anything in a boardroom. To assume that the financial controller might be keeping historical records, that's a bit dangerous.
and so with a lot of those community clubs, one of the big issues they've got is, and you don't get the turnover committees and you don't get the volunteers that want to be on it, because that administrative side of it has grown and grown and grown. And the requirements to report to, you know, council, to Community Affairs of Victoria, is a tennis club. We also do reports into Tennis Victoria. Everybody wants a piece of the action. And they don't, the reporting's not harmonised. You have to do slightly different things for each report you do. So it's actually very onerous for volunteers. So it's not surprising that they don't have the records like that. But the other thing is, there is no central repository for all of that information. So, you know, it's on your C drive. And so you might have, I did the whole ceremonial thing of copying everything onto a stick and handing it over to my husband. Now, we got a Dropbox. But it was my personal Dropbox that we were using, we're trying to share. So clubs don't necessarily have the funds to have the infrastructure for those things. It's interesting. But I think there's a few problems with community clubs. Notwithstanding that, they're a really good opportunity for people to earn their stripes, if you like.
Yeah. I think the turnover is one of their biggest challenges. People get onto those committees, they see the volume of the work, they do what they can, they work hard, they contribute, they become a resource in some circumstances, and then they're burnt out and they do 12 months and they're so fast to get out of there that we're literally sort of handing the baton to the next person.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you rely on that person.
And that's where some of those sporting bodies, I think, can play a better role. Tennis has done a few things, like they've introduced a thing called Club Spark into the equation, where they've got systems to about membership, but this is more about the governance documents that I'm talking. There doesn't really seem to be a great solution for that. And clubs generally don't have the money to subscribe to some of the cloud-based solutions. There are things out there, but they're really more expensive than I think some of the clubs are willing to pay for it. So I think councils and so on have probably got more responsibility there than they currently take if they want the governance and the reporting. So, you know.
And I think that's one of the challenges of board work in Australia, that you've got this multi-layered environment. I think there's more than 700 pieces of legislation that impact on, yeah, on business. So, you know, you've got the state level, you've got the Fed level, you've got the things for associations, the things for listed boards, then you've got your industry regulations, and then you've got, yep, your health and safety and your competition law and consumer law. Yep. And there's so many different pieces coming at you that if you are not-for-profit, a small organisation, you've still got the same weight of all those laws, yeah, and regulations. You've still got the same responsibilities as any director in any organisation.
Yeah, correct.
But you haven't got the resource. You just haven't.
I mean, exactly. I mean, it's a great opportunity to learn and to get your head around all this stuff. And there are resources. So, for example, Tennis Victoria put on resources and they try and help you. But it, yeah, certainly was massive advantage for me, both having an MBA but also having the company director stuff and some board experience already. So, yeah, I went into that secretary role really, you know, I just self-helped on Google how to write a special resolution.
But to a certain extent they were lucky to have you, because, yeah, in my experience, it's not always highly skilled people on those associations. A, yeah, lot of the time you get, you know, very well-meaning members of the community that think it's a cup of tea and a chocolate biscuit and a chance to get together, yeah, once a month, and really don't understand the work, yeah, that goes on in those boardrooms. They're quite hectic.
Yeah, no, it's true. That is true. I mean, I had quite a lot of fun with it because I did go in there quite experienced in that regard, and I enjoyed it. And I had a very clear understanding of all the things that needed to be done and, yeah, and organised. And I just systematically kind of worked through them over a five-year period, I suppose, and we got, yeah, ourselves real, because in that time we entered into a memorandum of understanding with another organization, which is, I'm now on their board, another member association, and so I'll explain that again in a minute. But we would not have been able to enter into that arrangement if we hadn't got our own house in order,
yeah,
to then set up a memorandum of understanding. There's never in a million years would we have been in a position to enter into that agreement if we hadn't sorted ourselves out and got our constitution, yeah, organised, got our contracts organised, got everything. Because we wouldn't have been able to say, okay, out of this MOU, this is what we need out of it, and this is what you need. We wouldn't have had that clarity. It just wouldn't have happened. And that actually has been a huge, huge coup for us in our sector, because our memorandum of understanding has basically organised that the members of this particular other entity are honorary members of ours, and then we have a whole bunch of underpinning arrangements underneath that, which has effectively secured our financial sustainability.
Right.
So we still do a little bit of fundraising here and there, the odd Bunnings barbecues when you're allowed to do them, and a few bits and pieces like that. But on the whole, we don't have to do that anymore. We can just focus on the organisation of the sport, which is what people join those clubs to do in the first,
yeah,
place. And then they get sucked into this vortex of hideous, hideous reporting and governance and people wanting stuff off you all the time. And it's just, it's like wading through concrete, I think, sometimes trying to get to the end point of,
yeah,
we're just running this community club on behalf of council to enable sport in the community, but you're making our lives so miserable and awful. So that's just it's a sector I think that needs sorting out, but notwithstanding, yeah, that, it's a great opportunity to learn things. And for the last 5 years, I kept trying to appeal to our junior membership base. You know, we've got people playing that are 16, 17, 18, whatever, going to university. What a great opportunity. Come on the board, join the thing, represent your, yeah, age group, learn how to do this governance thing. And I just couldn't get anyone on, which was probably my biggest disappointment, is that I couldn't persuade some of the younger people to get on to learn, use, yeah, that as a launching pad for other things to differentiate them on their kind, yeah, of CV from other people, yeah, as well. So that's probably the one thing that I didn't achieve that I would really have liked to have seen happen.
Yeah, and I think part of that is about changing the perception of boards as well. The more younger people we get onto boards, the younger those boards become and the more enticing they are for the young people. You don't find many young people on the boards.
And I think, you know, they're a perfect place to start. You know, people like looking and so on. If you're a member of a club, you know, that put your hand up. It's unbelievable how few people put their hands up. And to me, there's such a great opportunity to learn the basics and not go in as that person with no board experience.
Yeah, and also to represent your own interests, right? To tell that board what 17-year-olds want out of tennis, you know, because what the 17-year-old wants out of tennis can be very different to what the 35-year-old and the 55-year-old want out of
Correct.
Tennis. So, yeah, very interesting.
So, you know, it's have a voice, you know, that sort of thing. So there are opportunities and there are loads of things. I'm sure people can find things that interest them. Tennis has just been a huge part of my family and my family's life. That was just, you know, if you can't beat them, join them kind of thing. But
I love how all of your board roles are aligned to things you love. They're aligned to textiles and tennis. And
So actually the reason I had to step down off as secretary of the board that I'm on is that I'm now on another board for the company that we entered into the MOU with. So this is how you see how this sort of relatedness comes into it. But the entity that I've just joined the board for, it's over a year actually, is, well, it's called Mulgrave Country Club, but it's actually probably a social club. It's in the hospitality, gaming and liquor industry, and that's added a whole new bunch of things to the knowledge base, because it's the gambling, tourism, you know, it's got poker machines which a lot of people think are not socially acceptable. So I'm working my way through working out how all of this all fits together, and obviously it's highly, highly regulated, and that's been closed now for I don't know how many weeks. So there's no income or revenue coming in, but those organisations by legislation have to donate a whole bunch of money. They pay tax and all that sort of stuff anyway, but they also have to donate money to community projects and so on. And I was looking at the data the other day, and quite apart from the own things that they support, I think 300 odd thousand had been spent and gifted to community groups. And you know, cerebral palsy stuff, but other sports groups, footy clubs, et cetera, in the community. So we were meant to be doing a whole bunch of strategic planning in April, and that unfortunately got put by the wayside. And so the whole strategic situation has changed massively. And, you know, we've been closed 100% twice. So they're doing some takeaway meals and things like that, but that'll be an interesting board meeting next week. So in that role, I'm on the subcommittee for the sport. So that particular club provides its membership with tennis, golf, squash, bowls, snooker competition. I did have cricket, but cricket stopped. So you could join all these different sports things, and I'm on the committee for that. And so that was part of the rules, were that I couldn't be on the committee for any of the sports sections represented by that entity. I dropped the secretary thing, and I'm on the subcommittee for the sports and on the board. So that's to manage conflicts of interest in terms of how funding is kind of allocated. So I'm quite looking forward to that, because I have been able to secure a University of Melbourne project team that are going to look at the sports membership, and the project starts next week, and it's going to be about, you know, what should our sports membership look like in 10 years time if we were really thriving and successful as a sports club? What would people be saying about us, all that sort of thing? What would our membership profile look like? So I'm really, really interested, because they're quite an analytical bunch. I've seen the student profiles. They're postgraduate students in the college business and economics at Melbourne. Never had a business project before, but now you talk about closing the loop around. The person who organises those projects is someone who used to work for one of my really close friends who, when I did the MBA. So that's how I sort of got that wheels within. There's always wheels within wheels somewhere.
Yes.
So I'm quite excited about that. Instead of this thing being sort of sitting underneath whatever the strategy was that said in April, we've had to flip it around, and it'll be what are our options and choices if we're thinking about these things in sport that will then become a major input to the strategy process for the overall thing when we finally get to do that. So that's why, you know, quite excited. That's a bit of a fun project for the year.
That's really interesting. You've talked about a lot of challenges there. I love how the same kind of traits keep coming across in all of your examples. You're obviously very forward thinking, you know, how's this going to look in 10 years time?
Yeah.
You've obviously got the inquiry in mind. We often talk about curiosity being the key trait for a board director. You've got to wonder, you can't assume anything. You've always got to be curious. So you've obviously got those key traits. What advice would you have for anybody who's looking for their first board role?
Yeah, look, it's a really tricky one, because from my personal experience, you know, I'm a member of Women on Boards and things like that, and those roles come up. I think my personal experience is it's through networks and people that you know. I think when it comes down to a choice on paper, and it's probably the same for applying for jobs, if people kind of know of you or have some experience of you, you've got an advantage over someone who's just, they don't know from a bar of soap from what you've written on the piece of paper. And so that's why I think you have to plan for this as a sort of, know where you want to end up, but you've got to have like steps along the way that could help you get there, which is why I talked a bit about the sports board and the community board, because those organisations really are crying out for someone to help them. But you have to be a bit authentic about it. You can't just turn up at a club, join tomorrow and go, I want to be on your board now. Like, it needs to be something that you're interested in and appeals to you in some sort of way. So I see all the time things on Women on Boards that are advertised, but literally, and every now and again I'll put in an application, but only for things that really interest me, because you can't be vanilla about this stuff. I think it has to resonate, and you've just got to keep trying. You know, I've had plenty of knockbacks, plenty of things have happened that I've put up my hand for, and I thought, wow, I'm supremely qualified for that, but clearly somebody else didn't think so. And so, well, it is what it is. So I don't think it's personal. I've been on the other side of appointing people for committees and things like that, and sometimes they just want a good geographic spread of people. And it's as simple as that. And they've already got two people from where you're from. So it's not a reflection on you necessarily. So I think you have to be really clear about why you want to do it. And I see, for me, that being on boards is part of a portfolio of everything that I do. So I teach strategy at RMIT to postgraduate students, and strategy and innovation has always been my thing. So design thinking, voice of the customer, again, getting the requirements for innovation. So it's always that future looking kind of stuff. But I also do that work, and I apply a lot of the things that I teach in the projects that I do for individual clients. And then the next, and most of them are quite senior, they're high, you know, senior executives in organizations, and smaller organizations, but they're reporting to the CEO, or they are the CEO, and then they have to report to a board. So understanding what boards are looking for as well is helpful in how you shape the services that you offer. So it's a bit of a virtuous circle. So for me, the board roles, as much as anything, can I contribute? Can I make a difference? Because if I can't make a difference, I'm really, what's the point? Like, I've got other things to do with my time and my life. Is my contribution going to be valued or not? So I have had a board situation, a role where I probably asked too many questions, and there were things that they didn't want people to find out.
Yeah.
And so hustled, not renewed on that board. And you know what? I never felt any regret for that. I'm a bit annoyed that happened, and that the thing that in my value judgment was not correct didn't get acted on. But I didn't. It never upset me that I felt like I finished up there with stuff that was unfinished, if that makes sense. Because I knew that I couldn't do any more anyway. Because if that's where they're at, it doesn't matter how many times you bang your head up against a brick wall. Mm-hmm. If they're not going to move from that position, there's no value in time. Yes, I was being paid, but it wasn't much. It was maybe $600 a day or something. Who cares? You know, that doesn't matter anymore. But so for me, nothing more frustrating than banging my head up against a brick wall. If I can't make a difference and I can't make a valuable contribution, and all people want you to do is be a body in a chair that rubber stamps what they're doing anyway, that doesn't interest me. So you've got to think through some of those sorts of things about how you value your own time as well.
In hindsight, was there anything you could do in terms of upfront due diligence that might have exposed some of that information to you, or was it just that was consequential of being on that board?
Yeah, it's interesting. So a couple of boards I got on, one of them was the, which I will talk and mention, was the Cooperative Research Centres one. Fantastic. I was on that board for 5 years. It was about long-term research and research efforts, about collaborations that would solve Australia's big challenges, etc. Fantastic board. What a great set of people on that board. No question was the wrong question. Everybody liked to be challenged because they didn't want to be the smartest person in the room. They wanted to surround themselves with smart people. Yeah. Such an enjoyable board to be on, and 5 years of really fantastic work. And I don't know how I got appointed to that. I don't know who nominated me. So some of these things you don't actually apply for. You get tapped on the shoulder. So that was that. So this other one, I was all similarly tapped on the shoulder. So I thought, this is great, you know, because I finished this other one. But it wasn't the same experience. So I could say the Cooperative Research Centres board I was on, what a fantastic, fantastic board. No question was a stupid question. Now, I was interested on some boards where you're a bit afraid to ask a question. And what I have learned through the years is that a lot of questions, if you've got a question, you probably need to find someone on the board that you feel safe talking to, where you can say, look, I'm thinking this, I'm not sure about this, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about this, and you don't have the conversation in the boardroom.
That's good advice.
A lot of the times, and it took me a little while to kind of learn that process, that a lot of the conversations that I've had, and the boardroom process in many respects is running through things quite quickly, not a huge amount of discussion. And some people are they think it's a really good thing to do a board meeting in record time. so some of it, they don't want to have that discussion. So I think you need to find quite quickly someone on the board, if you get appointed to a board, that you're comfortable to have a conversation with about things that you're not sure about. It might be the chair, might not be the chair. But typically, if you want to question something that's going on in that board meeting, you do need to have a conversation with the chair before you get into the board meeting. Because it's a no surprises rule. You don't want to sideline someone without giving them the heads up. If you like, you're uncomfortable with something, you don't fully agree with what's being put in front of you, because they need to work out how they're going to manage that with the board. So you do have to have a relationship with the chair, I think, to do that. So that's one of the things that I'd learned. I thought, you know, at first you had all these discussions at the board. No, you don't. You have them before going there. So you have to read your papers. I mean, a lot of time reading the papers and working through it and making your notes on what you really want to ask. It's not a random thought bubble discussion in a boardroom.
Yeah, it's not, you know, turn up and we'll flick through these papers while we're here. It's all preparation. I love what you said there about vanilla, you know, doing the roles that are a bit vanilla and not aligned to your purpose. Because I was thinking, as you said, that as you're building your board career, as you're starting to progress for those bigger, juicier roles, if you like, the roles, you know, that you've been aiming for, if you've got a CV that shows some progression in terms of your passions or your pursuit, then that's going to sort of put you in a good light for an interview. Whereas if you've got a sporadic, ad hoc, moving around different associations, bouncing around, and there's no kind of correlation between the roles, then that might demonstrate that you've got a bit of experience and you've worked in different areas, but it's not really going to show any authenticity towards your board work, is there?
Well, it's a funny thing. I sometimes ask myself the question, because that's me and that authenticity part of it. And the other thing, you know, the choices that you have with what you do with your time. I often look at what men do and I sort of think, but I can't see any theme there, or I can't see any connection there. I can't see even a previous experience there, but somehow they're appointed for things that you can't clearly see that they're experienced for. And so I don't know. Sometimes I can't quite join the dots on some of those things. I'm not really sure.
So mystery.
I sometimes wonder, should we be thinking more like men? But again, it's not that. It's not about, for me, having, I'd always like to have one or two board roles on the go from that portfolio perspective of going with the other things that I do. I don't know if I would just go for board roles just to have board roles. I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of risk associated with these things as well. Like, you know, some of the issues that are coming up from a governance perspective, you know, trading insolvent, and that would be really concerning right now with COVID-19 and all those sorts of things. So it depends what your risk appetite as well, and how ambitious you are in terms of being on these corporate boards or listed boards or things like that. But that is not a type of organisation that I personally would be going for. Yeah. I've kind of got to a stage in my life where I think the community contribution is a bit more interesting. Or for me, it's the contribution towards the advancement of the economy or the country, like a sort of forward-thinking R&D-ish kind of thing.
And that's probably a whole other conversation there about whether it's a male-female thing, or, you know, is it that that's the old way of doing things and people just went from board role to board role because of who they knew, and now it's about passion and commitment and it's a different ball game. Is it because women traditionally are the rearers of the children, so they're in the community and they're more involved in the sporting pursuits and the schools and the kindies, so they kind of gravitate towards those to help out because it's part of raising the children. Probably a whole another conversation. But look, I've loved listening to you today and hearing your story. There's been some really fabulous pieces of advice in there. So thank you for all of your sharing.
Thank you, Sally.
It's been great to catch up.
I've taught heaps, but I would like, if I can, just to add one more story. Yes. That was, you know, one of the questions you asked was about the challenges of being on the board. That very first board that I went on, the International Fibre Centre, I shouldn't mention names, but it doesn't exist as an organisation anymore anyway. But the CEO that I had the interview with, he was acting CEO, and he had declared that he wasn't going to apply for the real CEO role, and that one of the things that was going to happen when I first started on this board was there was going to be a CEO interview and selection process. And so that was all fine, that was really good, and so they put it out and people applied, and this guy came in that everyone was thinking, oh, you know, he's going to be really good. And then the acting CEO said he would put his hand up too. So it was probably one of the most awkward periods of my entire life, where I was really split. This person had got me onto the board. They were now standing as CEO. It went down to a vote. It was pretty close on the wire. And this other guy got the job, not the acting CEO. The very next board meeting, the former acting CEO was there because he was acting CEO because he had been a board member before. And it was the most, oh my God, awkward moment in my life. So that was a real life challenge of something that had gone on that I would never in a million years have anticipated. It was sort of a baptism by fire, actually, with my first one or two board meetings.
That's a real sticky wicket, that one, because there's an assumption we make that the CEO is competent, they're great at what they do, you know, and we can just sort of work cohesively with that CEO to get all of our needs met. But just sometimes the CEO can cause a problem for the business. They can be too involved in the board. It can be too personal. I can't believe that CEO remuneration used to be with the CEO in the room in some board sometimes. Can you imagine doing a performance review with the person sat there? That's incredible.
Yeah, well, I know you're going to edit and do different bits of this, but this is actually a really interesting, talking about CEO remuneration. We actually went through that process. The board that I didn't get renewed on, the CEO remuneration, because remuneration can go up and up and up just purely by length of service beyond, if you like, what should be acceptable for that role if you went out to market again with someone new. But because they've been there 10 years, whatever it is, it's sort of gone up, but it's out of the sector. So we had a really interesting case where the chair of the board, he basically told the board, well, this is what I've agreed with the CEO, blah, 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 and this is what his remuneration and terms are going to be. And we went, hang on, aren't you supposed to discuss that with us first and get some feedback on this? And this is where all the rot started setting in, because we said, well, we think we should get the salary benchmarked, and we got I'm not sure who did it actually, Mercer or Hayes, someone who does salary benchmarking for the sector. So they did this whole process whereby they interviewed people, understood the complexity of the role and the job, benchmarked it to various sectors, and said this is what it is, and it was significantly higher than it should have been, and could have been a bit of an embarrassment to the two governments, Australian and New Zealand governments, that were responsible, if you like, for that entity. And so that all went a bit to shit. I mean, if you don't want to call it that, because people thought, oh my God, well, you can't pay the person any less. No, you can't. But then you have to work out how you're going to deal with that and handle it. And that's actually the beginning, if you like, of the questioning that wasn't very popular. But it is what it is, you know. And you can see very easily how those remuneration things. There were a couple of things wrong there. Obviously, the way that it was approached hadn't involved the board in the feedback in the way that it should have in terms of the CEO performance. And then there was this overpayment issue. So everyone was sitting on a very nice wicket. So if you want to poke the bear, you've got to be really careful. You've got to be prepared for the outcomes that come out of that. But I actually personally don't regret it for a minute. I mean, I like to think that we made them feel uncomfortable and squirm a bit. But of course, at the end of the day, you could argue, well, they're still there and a couple of other people are not. So they get away with it. They make it work for them. But you've got to feel, I think, comfortable within yourself that you've poked the bear because the bear needed to be poked.
And that's why I asked the question about due diligence, because, you know, you end up working with these people and, you know, you can't flee the sinking ship. So if you can see that it's bad, just walking away sometimes isn't enough. You at least need to poke that bear a couple of times and then say, look, I've poked, I've done my best, and now I'm out of here.
And you've got to be prepared to walk away with it, because people will accept things that you might not necessarily accept. I mean, we'd all love the luxury of all these boards being put in front of us that we can do due diligence and say, I choose that one. That's not the way that it works. And these things come up in weird and wonderful ways. And I think if you circle it back to what you said before, you need the plan. You need to think, what am I really trying to achieve here? Why am I trying to achieve it? What am I going to get out of it? And what am I going to contribute to someone else? And then you've got to get out there and you've got to let people know you're interested in opportunities, but you've also got to put your hand up. And I think, you know, there are lots of pro bono opportunities out there, but my recommendation would be do your one or two, but don't go nuts on it, because you use those one or two to get what you need out of it. And yes, you're making a contribution that they need, but you shouldn't be going pro bono for the rest of your life. Yeah. At some point, you are an experienced director and you should be remunerated for your contribution and your time.
Yeah.
And so my tennis committee board, and now I get an honorarium for the one that I am on currently, but I've said, well, if you're not getting paid, don't pay me. But it's not enough for me to worry about. So it's no skin off my nose in that sense. So I think for me, it's not just about the money, it's about the contribution.
Yeah, and you hear that a lot. You hear executive professional non-executive directors who have their paid work that fulfills all their kind of skill sets and drive and ambitions, and then they have the not-for-profits that fulfill their passions and make them feel like they're contributing. So you are able, it's one of those few careers where you can balance the paid stuff with the giving back stuff, and you're still doing the same role.
It's been that's why you can't do too many of them, because you still need to be paid somehow.
Yes, yeah, you do. You've got to make an income, right? I've spoken to NEDs that only do not-profit work, and that's, you know, that's their choice in life, but your income has to come from somewhere. So if you have the income coming in that you can do that, that's great. But if you don't have the income coming in, then yeah, it's got to pay. It's got to pay, absolutely. Yeah. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you, Dalief. Thank you so much for your time today. And thank you for just being so open and honest and raw. There was a lot of fabulous advice there. Thank you.
No problem at all. And I hope it's helpful and helps people work out what they want out of this.
You've been listening to Insider Insights with Sally Parrish. Insider Insights is the place to meet non-executive directors and go inside their boardroom to learn from their experience. We hope you've discovered some great learnings today that you can apply to your board role. We look forward to your company on the next episode of Insider Insights.